and such a crisis in 1982. The company heeled over so far that the senior executives on the bridge were practically catapulted into the raging torrent. The result? A company previously plagued with internal dissension as executives tried to advance their own careers and workers sought wages and benefits divorced from productivity gains, suddenly had a new sense of purpose and team spirit in saving itself from oblivion. Organizational changes that had seemed impossible were suddenly easy. GM and the European mass producers, by contrast, have had periods of low profits and crises from other causes, but have never had the sense that their whole approach to production is doomed. So they seem to be dying the death of a thousand cuts as the world's lean producers, now including Ford, steadily gain ground. The trick for investors and bankers when the crisis comes is to offer help, but only in return for the company's realistic plans for achieving world-class performance by converting to lean production. Governments may also need to help out by establishing paid training programs for employees that companies can no longer use. These excess workers are the heart of the conversion problem. That's because workers at mass production plants learn no skills. So when a mass production company collapses, most workers can qualify only for the most entry-level jobs in other sectors. Training these displaced workers for meaningful work will be essential. Indeed, a major problem in converting from mass to lean production is that in a highly competitive marketplace, where share growth is impractical, a substantial fraction of the workforce is no longer needed. If the European volume producers were to convert to lean production today without gaining market share, they would need less than half their current workforce. Doubtless, the market for cars and trucks would grow as competition pushed prices down, but it is unrealistic to think that shedding of labor can be avoided. One of the most important tenets of the Toyota production system is never to vary the work pace. Therefore, as efficiencies are introduced in the factory or design shop, or as the rate of production falls, it is vital to remove unneeded workers from the system so that the same intensity of work is maintained. Otherwise, the challenge of continual improvement will be lost. The same is true of mass production companies converting to lean production. Excess workers must be removed completely and quickly from the production system if improvement efforts are not to falter. Companies such as GM have tried to do so by creating job banks of excess workers to be retrained for other jobs in the company. The problem is that, realistically, there will never be any other jobs within the mass production companies, and the ability of the companies to finance the job banks will decay over time as well. So some sort of public support for job banks may be necessary, and workers will have to be trained for positions outside the traditional manufacturing industries. This idea is sternly resisted by government officials and union leaders in many Western countries, the former because of the upfront cost to governments, the latter because the union loses strength as workers leave their companies. However, the alternative approach of propping up mass producers through trade and investment barriers so they can afford to continue their inefficient use of human effort is far more costly in the long term. Obstacle 2. Outdated thinking about the world economy. Once upon a time, not very long ago, most people thought that the world economy advanced by moving the production of standardized, low-priced products, such as small automobiles and trucks, to new mass production factories in newly industrializing countries. In the 1970s, the rise of Japan was often explained in this way. 5 years ago, when we started our project, many observers expected that Japan would soon find it could no longer compete in the export of small vans and trucks because of the strengthening of the yen and its effect on Japanese wages. Korea, Taiwan, Thailand, and Malaysia, the next tier of countries with low wages and an educated, industrious workforce, would collectively become the next Japan. These countries, it was argued, would rapidly build up their economies the way Japan had, through the export of small cars and trucks to the United States and Europe, supplanting Japanese products in the process. We never subscribed to this view because we knew that lean production is more than a match for low-wage mass production. First, lean production dramatically raises the threshold of acceptable quality to a level that mass production, particularly in low-wage countries, cannot easily match. Second, lean production offers ever-expanding product variety and rapid responses to changing consumer tastes, something low-wage mass production finds hard to counter except through ever-lower prices. Continually dropping prices is unlikely to work, however, because a third advantage of lean production is that it dramatically lowers the amount of high-wage effort needed to produce a product of a given description, and it keeps reducing it through continuous incremental improvement, as we saw in Chapter 4. Finally, lean production can fully utilize automation in ways mass production cannot, further reducing the advantage of low wages. The expansion of the Korean motor industry in the 1980s sums up this situation. In 1979, Korea was nowhere in the auto industry. Despite government protection of the domestic market since 1962, the Korean industry, consisting of four small producers, had not gotten very far. Hyundai was the most advanced, and unlike its rivals, was to a considerable degree independent of the U.S., European, and Japanese assemblers. Its Pony model used an independently engineered body and an engine and transmission wholly manufactured in Korea from designs licensed from Mitsubishi. It had enjoyed some modest export success, mostly in third world markets, such as in Latin America, where it sold on price. The other small companies, Daewoo, Kia, and Dongae, made vehicles solely for sale in the Korean domestic market, using designs licensed from European companies. Unlike Hyundai, they were completely dependent on their European partners for technology. The world economic crisis of 1979 and 1980 hit particularly hard in Korea. Domestic sales collapsed. So did Hyundai's exports, once Japanese companies dropped their prices in order to maintain their sales in export markets. This crisis gave the Korean Ministry of Industry the chance it had been waiting for, the opportunity to rationalize the industry over the opposition of the Chaebol, Korea's version of the Japanese Keiretsu, in the way the Ministry of International Trade and Industry, MITI, had wanted to do in Japan in the 1950s. The ministry pushed Kia and Dongae out of the industry for 5 years, while assigning Hyundai small cars and Daewoo larger ones. Hyundai, in particular, took this directive as a sign to produce down the path to high-volume mass production. It began to plan a new model, the Excel, which would be built in a massive new factory in Ulsan, mostly for export to the United States and Europe. The Excel was almost entirely based on licenses from Mitsubishi in Japan. Indeed, it was practically indistinguishable in general specifications from Mitsubishi's Colt model. Hyundai's strategy was simple. It would compete by underpricing the Japanese entry-level cars based on low wages and high volume. For a brief period, the strategy worked brilliantly. Hyundai's Excel arrived in the vital U.S. market in 1986, just as the Japanese were raising their prices to counter the strengthening of the yen. Americans assumed that any Asian car, particularly one with a Japanese design, would have Japanese quality, and at a price $1,000 below Japanese vehicles in the same size range, the Excel seemed unbeatable. Sales quickly grew to 350,000 per year, and Hyundai scrambled to add capacity in Korea with a second 300,000-unit assembly plant. The Korean Ministry of Industry was so impressed with Hyundai's triumph that it soon permitted Kia back into the auto market. Kia would build a small car based on the Mazda 121 to be sold in the United States by Ford as the Festiva. In addition, Daewoo was allowed to build a second, smaller model based on the German Opel Kadett, for sale in the United States through General Motors dealers as the Pontiac Le Mans. By 1988, the Korean producers were selling 500,000 cars in the United States, accounting for 4% of the total market. Then, the Korean strategy fell apart. Hyundai was, in fact, an old-fashioned mass producer, with low wages but a large number of hours expended per car. When the Korean currency began to strengthen rapidly against the dollar in 1988, and Korean auto workers demanded large wage increases, a large part of the Koreans' cost advantage disappeared. At that point, the question of quality emerged. The early Hyundai cars sold in the United States had very poor quality, as shown in the J.D. Power data we used in our assembly plant studies in Chapter 4. In 1987, when the average Japanese car was reported by consumers to have about 0.6 defects, the Hyundai cars had 3.1. As the word began to spread, the Korean producers found it necessary to slash prices to sustain sales, just at the point when their production costs were soaring. The consequence was that Korean sales in the United States fell 50% between 1988 and 1990. The next Japan was no longer the next Japan. What's more, by the late 1980s, it had become apparent that there would be no next Japan, even if a developing country created a lean production industry that could match the product quality and labor productivity of the best lean producers. Japan's success had so sensitized the world trading system to massive inflows of industrial products from one region to another that no country could realistically hope to pick up where Japan left off. Indeed, at the peak of the Korean auto sales in North America in 1988, the U.S. government pushed the Korean government hard to reduce its growing overall trade surplus by 50%, which the Koreans did. Hyundai became convinced that to protect its access to the North American market, it would need to follow the Japanese transplants in building an assembly plant in North America. Its 100,000-unit Bremont, Quebec plant opened in 1989 to assemble the mid-size Sonata, a new model it hoped would restore its fortunes in the North American market. The idea of a company from a developing country building a major manufacturing facility in a highly developed, high-wage country would have been unthinkable only 5 years earlier, at a time when most observers predicted an inexorable drift of low-tech manufacturing, including cheap autos, out of the developed world. After all, Korea's entire advantage was expected to be low wages. But because Korean wages are rapidly converging with those in North America, and political considerations require manufacture within the North American region, Korea is now assembling cars in Canada. What do we conclude from the experience of Hyundai and the other Korean producers? That the world economy, in a short period, has changed in remarkable ways. First, the triumph of lean production has created a new threshold for product quality that no producer can hope to offset merely through low prices based on low wages. As a result, producers in the next tier of developing countries must become lean producers as well. As we will see shortly, it is quite feasible for them to move toward their goal in the 1990s. Second, even those developing countries mastering lean production will need to think anew about the market for their products. Partly, they should look at home, because the productivity gains of lean production should bring motor vehicles into reach of a much larger fraction of domestic consumers. In Brazil, for example, we found that 50 hours were needed to assemble our standard small car, compared with 13 at the best Japanese lean producer. Not surprisingly, the Brazilian car market has been stuck at about 1 million units for many years. About one-third of the difference in performance is due to greater automation in the highest productivity Japanese plant, but complete introduction of lean production without advanced technology should cut the level of effort in Brazil in half, opening a vast new domestic market. The developing countries should also look for regional markets. Indeed, the most striking feature of the world economy in the past few years is the sudden reorientation of the trading patterns in manufactured goods from cross-regional, across the great oceans, to intra-regional, within the great regions, North America, Europe, East Asia. The motor industry is perhaps the leader in this trend. Exports from Japan to Europe are stable, while Japanese and European exports to North America are falling dramatically, and European exports to Japan are growing dramatically from a very small base. We don't, of course, count as exports cars manufactured in the United States and Europe by Japanese companies. What we expect by the end of the decade is a much lower volume of total exports between regions, a greater balance in the remaining trade flows, and a focus for the remaining cross-regional trade on niche-type, specialty products. This approach, of course, is precisely the one proposed for the post-national lean enterprises we described in Chapter 8. Meanwhile, within the great regions, the flow of products among countries should increase dramatically. Let's begin with North America. The United States and Canada began to integrate their auto industries in 1965, when the Canada-U.S. Auto Pact went into effect. For the participating assembler companies, the U.S. Big Three, this meant that cars and trucks could be made in one country and shipped to the other for sale without paying tariffs, as long as the assemblers met modest Canadian requirements to keep Canadian production roughly proportional to Canadian sales. This point quickly became moot as Canada began to run a substantial trade surplus with the United States. In 1989, the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement set in motion the final process of integration of the automotive market by eliminating by the mid-1990s all remaining tariffs on the flow of parts between the two countries. An interesting issue in the North American region is Mexico. For a period of 30 years from the beginning of the 1960s, Mexico tried to develop a domestic motor industry that could supply the Mexican market with all its needs. To achieve this goal, the Mexican government in 1962 prohibited the imports of finished vehicles and imposed high local content requirements on the five foreign companies, Ford, GM, Chrysler, Nissan, and Volkswagen, building cars in Mexico. The policy was both a spectacular success and a spectacular failure. By 1980, Mexico had a 500,000-unit motor vehicle industry producing vehicles with perhaps 50% local content. Unfortunately, the industry, with market share restrictions and a host of other protections for the domestic assemblers and parts suppliers, was totally uncompetitive in both cost and quality in the world market. With five producers making three or four separate models each in a 500,000-unit market, average annual production totaled about 25,000 units of each product, far too low even for today's lean producers to make economically. What's more, the Mexican plants were in no way lean. Even Nissan, a lean producer in Japan, employed a combination of craft and mass production methods at its Cuernavaca plant. Mexican policy might have continued on its course except for the economic collapse beginning in 1981. As domestic demand tumbled and Mexico's foreign debt mounted in 1983, the government examined its auto policy. Its initial strategy was to push even further down the path to mass production by limiting each assembler to a single product while raising the required domestic content level. Government officials reasoned that although Mexican car and truck buyers would have very limited choices, economies of scale should cause the cost of cars and trucks to fall as volume increased. What was more, the Mexican trade deficit in automotive products should fall as domestic content grew. It soon became apparent that this strategy wouldn't work. The domestic market was simply too small, and the protected domestic producers too inefficient, Mexico would need to join the world. The first step was to permit Ford to build a new assembly plant in the northern city of Hermosillo. This plant had no domestic content requirements as long as it exported the great majority of its output. The Hermosillo plant also provided the first opportunity to experiment with lean production in Mexico. At this greenfield site, Ford applied what it had learned from Mazda in building a Mazda-designed car sold in the United States as the Mercury Tracer. Hermosillo was a great success in terms of productivity and quality. Mexican workers embraced lean production with the same speed as American workers at the Japanese transplants in North America and at Ford's own U.S. and Canadian plants. However, the plant failed to meet its cost targets because it was assembling its cars entirely from parts shipped from Japan. As the yen strengthened, Hermosillo, a plant envisioned by Mazda and Ford in the early 1980s as a way around the U.S.-instigated quota on Japanese finished unit imports, suddenly made no sense. What does make sense, and is also consistent with the concept of lean production, is to manufacture a large fraction of the parts, engine, transmission, and so forth, for the car, at Hermosillo, and serve the entire North American regional market, including Mexico. The Mexican government dramatically altered its strategy at the end of 1989 to make this approach more feasible, not just for Hermosillo, but for the entire Mexican motor vehicle industry. It dramatically reduced its local content requirements on individual products and relaxed its rules against the import of finished cars and trucks, while retaining its requirement that companies making and selling cars in Mexico balance their trade by exporting as much as they import. With this step, a new configuration of production for the entire North American region could emerge. GM, Ford, Chrysler, Nissan, and VW might assemble in Mexico for sale to the entire North American market cheap, entry-level cars and trucks that use parts produced by production complexes in northern Mexico, near the assembly plants. At the same time, larger cars and trucks for Mexican consumers might be supplied by plants in the U.S. and Canadian Midwest. While Mexico would run a substantial trade surplus with the United States and Canada, this integration of Mexico into the North American region should actually be a net gain for the U.S. and Canadian auto industries. That's because exports to Mexico from U.S.-Canadian plants would be additional business. No finished vehicle shipments have been permitted for the past 30 years. What's more, the Mexican market might grow very rapidly from its current base of 500,000 units to 2 million or more by the year 2000. The small cars and trucks manufactured in Mexico for sale in the United States and Canada would logically replace imports from Japan, Korea, and Brazil. Currently, these imported small vehicles provide no jobs in the United States and Canada. For this logic to be fulfilled, one change in U.S. policy will be necessary. The U.S. government's fuel economy regulations will need to be modified so that small cars produced in Mexico by U.S. companies with high levels of Mexican manufacturing value are treated as domestic products. Otherwise, the U.S. companies will not be able to participate fully in Mexico, leaving its potential to be realized by Japanese or European companies that are not similarly constrained. And some way must be found around the 25% American tariff on pickup trucks. The Mexican government proposal in March 1990 to open negotiations on a North American free trade zone may provide the best means of addressing this problem. A similar process of regional integration is now expected in Europe in the 1990s. The initial impetus was the European community's decision to remove remaining barriers to the flow of goods within the community, beginning in 1993. This move motivated the countries of the European Free Trade Area, Norway, Sweden, Iceland, Austria, Switzerland, and Finland, to seek their own integration into the European market. these historic decisions have been overshadowed for the moment by the dramatic changes in Eastern Europe and in the Soviet Union. Changes that suddenly raise the prospect of a gigantic European market of up to 750 million consumers, including those in Russia and the other European republics of the Soviet Union. If this market should actually come to pass, it would be 3 times the size of the U.S.-Canadian markets and 7 times larger than Japan's. For the motor vehicle industry, the logic of a united European region is similar to that for an integrated Mexican-Canadian-U.S. market. We expect that Eastern Europe will replace Spain as the production locale for the most inexpensive basic cars and trucks, and that the growing economies of Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Poland, and East Germany in particular will provide a market for larger cars and trucks produced in Western Europe. For example, Volkswagen has just begun assembly of its smallest model, the Polo, at the Trabant factory in East Germany. It plans to increase production to 250,000 units by 1994. GM has also formed a joint venture with the other East German producer, Wartburg, to produce 150,000 Opel Kadets. Fiat, meanwhile, has announced major ventures in Poland and the Soviet Union for production of up to 900,000 vehicles, many of which may be sold in Western Europe badged as Fiats. As in the case of Mexico, we also expect the East European countries to run a surplus in motor vehicle trade. Like Mexico, they are all deeply in debt and can scarcely afford to run a further deficit in automobiles, which are still consumer luxuries in most of these countries. Just as in the North American region, the West European auto industry can actually gain production volume from a fully integrated Europe if the low-cost, entry-level products produced in East Europe for sale in the West displace imports from East Asia. East Asia is itself the third emerging region, although behind North America and Europe in its development. Only a few years ago, the individual economies of Japan, Korea, and Taiwan were struggling to boost their exports of finished manufactured goods for the North American and European markets. They seemed almost oblivious of each other and were highly resistant to accepting manufactured goods imported from their neighbors. This situation is now changing rapidly, due partly to trade barriers and currency shifts that close off markets in the other regions, partly in response to the movement toward regionalization in Europe and North America. In 1989, for the first time since World War II, trade within the East Asian region exceeded extra-regional trade with North America and Europe. The logic of motor vehicle industry development in East Asia is similar, save in one respect, to that of North America and Europe. We expect more basic vehicles to be made in top-to-bottom manufacturing complexes in the developing countries of the region for sale in all countries of the region. We also expect the manufacture of more complex and expensive vehicles to be focused in Japan for export to other markets in the region. Indeed, this trend is already beginning. Hyundai, Kia, and Daewoo all plan to begin selling entry-level vehicles in Japan in 1991. The Korean domestic market, thus far closed to finished Japanese vehicles, will be opened a crack at the same time. While the domestic Japanese industry, unlike those in Western Europe and North America, is unlikely to prove better off under this arrangement, it can easily be no worse off if its exports of more luxurious vehicles grow enough to offset decreased domestic production of basic vehicles. The anomaly in East Asia, of course, is China. Until spring 1989, it seemed to be moving toward a more open stance regarding its economy and the world, and might logically have entered into a regional East Asia market on at least a limited basis. Perhaps it can yet do so in the 1990s, but for the moment, the Chinese industry is still focused inward, pursuing a combination of extremely rigid mass production in its 2 volume production complexes in Changchun, No. 1 Auto Works, and Hubei, No. 2 Auto Works, and inefficient low-quality craft production in about 100 additional vehicle manufacturing facilities spread throughout China. This disastrous combination gives China the distinction of having the world's largest motor vehicle industry in terms of employment, more than 1.6 million workers, and one of the smallest in terms of output, a projected 600,000 units in 1990. By contrast, in 1989, 500,000 employees in the Japanese auto industry produced 13 million vehicles, indicating a productivity gap of about 70 to 1 between two countries separated by 500 miles across the Yellow Sea. So much for the three great regions comprising about 90% of the current-day motor vehicle market. One of those countries, such as Brazil and Australia, with substantial motor industries, and others, such as India, with substantial aspirations. Where do they fit into the emerging world of regions and regional production systems? Our belief is that they must look primarily to their own regions for markets, but in creative ways. Let's take the two very different examples of Brazil and Australia. Brazil set out in the late 1950s to build a top-to-bottom motor vehicle production system. It permitted the multinational car companies, notably GM, Ford, Volkswagen, and Fiat, to own 100% of the equity in their Brazilian operations, but insisted that they quickly convert from kit building using imported parts to the use of practically 100% Brazilian parts in each vehicle. By the mid-1960s, in the midst of the Brazilian economic miracle, this goal had been achieved. The Brazilian industry reached 1 million units of production annually. Unfortunately, for 20 years now, Brazil has been a story of stagnation. As we noted, the mass production complexes built in Brazil were a notable achievement compared with the alternative, complete dependence on imports. However, these plants now lag far behind the world pace in terms of productivity and product quality. In addition, in the early 1970s, after oil prices soared, the government required that the industry introduce alcohol-fueled engines, a requirement that focused the industry's product development energies on a technology that has found no market elsewhere in the world. Meanwhile, the number of years each model was kept in production soared to 14 years in Brazil, nearly four times the Japanese standard. For a brief period in the mid-1980s, the Brazilian industry thought it had found a new strategy. It would take advantage of its low wages by exporting cheap cars to Europe and the United States. The models in question were the Volkswagen Fox subcompact, sold in the United States, and the Fiat Duna, sold in Europe. This was a Latin variant of the Korean strategy, which met with the same pattern of high hopes based on initial sales, followed by despair as currencies shifted and product shortcomings offset an initial price advantage. Fox sales in the U.S. market, for example, fell from a peak of 60,000 in 1987 to 40,000 in 1989. GM, meanwhile, canceled a tentative plan for Brazilian production of a mini minivan based on its German Opel Kadett, mainly for export to the United States. A more promising path for Brazil in the 1990s will consist of three elements. First, lean producers must show Brazil the way toward world-class manufacturing. Honda's motorcycle plant at Manaus, far up the Amazon, has clearly demonstrated that lean production can work in Brazil under the most demanding conditions. But automotive examples in the Brazilian industrial heartland near São Paulo are essential. Introduction of lean production can dramatically reduce production costs to spur the stagnant domestic market, where only the upper middle class can now afford the output of the inefficient mass production auto industry. Second, Brazil needs to open its industry to imports of whole vehicles and parts, so that real competition will be introduced into what is now a tight oligopoly. Because Brazil can hardly afford to run a trade deficit in motor vehicles, given its massive foreign debt, it will no doubt need to require that producers balance their trade. However, a truly competitive market can still be achieved with a flexible policy. The new Mexican auto decree shows one way to accomplish this end. Third, Brazil will need to integrate its production system with its neighbors, beginning with Argentina. By setting in motion a regionalization process as it brings production costs down, Brazil can develop a massive Latin American growth market that will not depend on favorable trade policies and currencies in the other great regions. While productive trade with those regions should still be possible, it will not be the key to the strategy. Thus, Brazil and its neighbors can control their own fate. Australia presents perhaps the most difficult instance of a country with a small and highly developed motor vehicle industry, but with an insufficient domestic market and, thus far, a lack of regional outlook. The Australian government decided in the 1960s that it would develop a top-to-bottom auto industry to replace both imported vehicles and the kit assembly of parts produced in Europe and North America. By the end of the 1960s, it had done so, but with all the disadvantages of mass production in a low-volume, highly protected market. Despite Australia's efforts in the 1980s to consolidate the five producers into three more viable production systems, and the presence of several Japanese producers, our IMVP assembly plant surveys have found productivity and quality levels far off the standard set by lean producers in Japan and North America. For a while in the mid-1980s, Australia thought that perhaps it too could succeed by following Korea's example. Ford proposed to export a specialty vehicle, a Mazda 323 modified as a convertible roadster, to be sold in the United States under the name Mercury Capri. This was at a time when the Australian dollar was very weak and the American dollar very strong. However, by the time the car was ready for production and a number of quality problems had been resolved, currencies had shifted and the car no longer made much economic sense. The effort illustrates once more the risk of an extra-regional export strategy in a world of fluctuating currencies. The logical path for Australia would be to reorient its industry toward the oceanic regional market, including Indonesia, Singapore, and the Philippines. Each country within this region might balance its motor vehicle trade, but collectively, by permitting cross-shipment of finished units and parts, they could gain the scale needed to reduce costs and let lean production flourish. Australia, as the most advanced country in the region, presumably would concentrate its own production on complex luxury vehicles, while Indonesia, at the other extreme, would make cheap, entry-level products. Unfortunately, nothing of this sort has happened. Australia views itself as part of the developed world and thinks naturally of exporting to North America, Europe, and even Japan, while Indonesia thinks of itself as part of the developing world of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, countries, and focuses on developing trade with Malaysia, the Philippines, and Thailand. Repeated efforts to develop an ASEAN mobile by pooling parts produced by different companies in each country have come to nothing because it doesn't make sense to do so in terms of the commercial strategy of the multinational assembler and component firms. Thus, the oceanic countries of the Southern Hemisphere constitute a region still waiting to happen. The same can be said of the countries of the Indian subcontinent and those of Southern Africa. As the rest of the world pursues a path of regionalization in the 1990s, we expect that regional thinking will grow in these areas as well. The combination of regional scale and lean production can be a particularly powerful stimulus to growth if the right policies are followed. Obstacle 3. Inward focus of the Japanese lean producers. The final obstacle to a lean world is, in fact, the Japanese lean producers themselves. How can this be? Many of you will no doubt have concluded that we think everything these companies do is good, compared with the bad practices of the Western mass producers. In one way, this impression is accurate. These companies have provided an invaluable gift to the world by pioneering a new way of making things that really is superior. But in another way, they lack a final and essential innovation, the ability to think and act globally rather than from a narrow national perspective. Anyone who reads the newspapers is aware of the growing backlash to Japanese direct investment in North America and Europe, what the Japanese themselves call investment friction. We regard this trend as a much greater threat to the eventual creation of a lean world than trade barriers on finished units and parts could ever be. This is because, in the worst case, it can lead to investment barriers that permanently seal off North America, Europe, and the other regions from Japanese lean competitors that can force everyone to become lean. Why is this backlash building when the Japanese companies are creating new jobs in new manufacturing complexes, making cars, trucks, and parts at levels of quality and productivity equal to those of the home plants in Japan? Partly, it seems, from the threat these facilities represent to established institutions, mass production companies, and mass production unions. Friction, for these reasons, is an inescapable component of change and progress. However, there is another more fundamental reason for friction. Many government officials, managers, and workers in the West perceive that the Japanese lean producers are offering two classes of citizenship in their organization. One for Japanese workers, a second for foreigners. One for Japanese suppliers, another for foreign suppliers, and one for Japanese group members of their keiretsu, but none at all for foreign companies. As Westerners watch the seemingly inexorable advance of the Japanese companies, this second-class citizenship begins to seem unacceptable. As one manager at GM remarked, "I can hope to get to the top at GM, but I can never hope to rise above the middle level of one of the Japanese foreign subsidiaries, no matter how superior my performance." Growing investment friction is the result. The outcome is uncertain. Executives at the Japanese companies are acutely aware of this problem and have given it much thought. One solution, now being pursued by several of the auto companies, is to appoint native managers to head their manufacturing operations in North America and Europe. Similarly, a group of Japanese companies are designating native supplier companies as their source for certain categories of components. Governments in both regions are supporting this approach through restrictions on visas for Japanese employees at the new facilities and, in Europe, through strong pressures to attain high levels of domestic content as soon as possible. The latter policy raises the cost and launch time of the initial facility substantially, unless most parts are obtained from existing domestic suppliers. The consequence, we fear, will be a repetition of Ford's experience in Britain after 1915. The wholesale substitution of domestic managers and suppliers to deal with investment friction quickly degraded the performance of Ford's production system toward the existing English level. While Ford did spur English producers to adopt new ways, the full benefits of mass production were never achieved. This is not an idle fear, based on events long ago. In our assembly plant survey of the transplants in North America and Europe, we found strong evidence that those plants that perform best are those with a very strong Japanese management presence in the early years of operations, and those that have moved slowly and methodically to build up their domestic supply base. The performance of other plants, which have turned over most management to North Americans and Europeans recruited at senior levels from Western car makers and who have hurriedly assembled a supply team, is better than the Western average, but in many cases not as good as the Western company, Ford, that has taken lean production to heart. It should be clear that the Japanese-ness of the management and the suppliers is not the issue. Rather, it is how well transplant managers and suppliers understand lean production, and how deeply they are committed to making it work. Unfortunately, at the moment, a large fraction of the world's managers with knowledge and commitment to leanness are Japanese. We would suggest that a better approach for the Japanese companies will be to build a truly global personnel system, in which new workers from North America, Europe, and every other region where a company has design, engineering, and production facilities are hired in at an early age and given the skills, including language skills and exposure to management in different regions, needed to become full citizens of these companies. This will mean an equal opportunity to head the company someday. Similarly, the Japanese lean assemblers will need to form supplier groups in each region where they operate by exchanging shares in supplier firms and offering full citizenship. They will also need to regionalize their equity base and borrowings so that shifting currencies will not hinder the most appropriate deployment of production in each region. Finally, a truly important advance in terms of its visibility will be for the Keiretsu to include foreign companies in their membership. For example, those Keiretsu, such as that of the Daiichi Kangyo Bank, with weaker auto companies among their members, Isuzu and Suzuki in this instance, might invite a strong Western car company to join. On the other hand, the one Japanese car company unaffiliated with a Keiretsu, Honda, might wish to form an international Keiretsu consisting of Western manufacturing companies and a bank. For any of these innovations to work, a clear two-way understanding will be essential. Western companies and employees will need to embrace the concept of reciprocal obligation, making a long-term commitment to the company or the group. Japanese companies, in turn, will need to abandon their narrow national perspective and quickly learn to treat foreigners who accept the obligations involved as full citizens. We are well aware how difficult these innovations will be to implement. American and European companies have struggled, in many cases for decades, to provide full citizenship for foreigners in their organizations. Yet there are still no foreigners in the senior management of General Motors or on its board. And it made headlines recently when Volkswagen appointed Daniel Goudver, a Frenchman, as the first foreigner on its management board. In addition, the Japanese will need to address issues of ethnic background and gender in providing citizenship for foreign employees, issues that they have not confronted in Japan, where there are practically no minorities and where women are notably absent from senior management, and where Japanese practice is far behind Western norms. Nevertheless, the Japanese must logically be the innovators in devising post-national, multi-regional corporate forms and providing full citizenship to their employees and suppliers drawn from many countries and regions across the globe. They have the financial resources that many Western companies lack, and they have the need. They risk investment barriers and other impediments to the expansion of their production systems if they don't. They should start right away by declaring their intention to proceed as post-nationals, companies where nationality is not related to promotion prospects, and by implementing post-national personnel, supplier, finance, and keiretsu systems that the outside world can examine. Transparency, the ability for outsiders to see the system in action, understand its logic, and verify its performance, is critical to Western acceptance because of the long time lag between initiating such a system and proving that it really works. For example, as young employees entering at the bottom rise to the top. One highly visible way to demonstrate their intent would be for Japanese companies to assign newly hired Westerners to work for several years in Japan, where there are presently practically no permanent non-Japanese employees of the big companies. Only a public and emphatic commitment to these final organizational innovations, which Western firms must match as well, will ensure the triumph of lean production for the Japanese companies and for the whole world. Such a commitment will also provide part of the essential glue to hold together the emerging world regions in North America, Europe, and Asia, regions no longer united by the familiar East-West conflict and in danger of drifting apart in the 21st century. Epilogue. When Henry Ford and Alfred Sloan created mass production, the ideas they incorporated were in the air all about them. Everywhere there was a sense that the older, craft-based modes of production had reached their limits. What was more, many parts of the mass production system had been tested previously in other industries. The meatpacking industry, for example, had pioneered moving disassembly lines for cutting up carcasses before the turn of the century. In the 1890s, the bicycle industry had pioneered many of the steel stamping techniques and dedicated machine tools Ford later used. Even earlier, the transcontinental railroads had developed many of the organizational mechanisms for managing large firms operating over vast areas. But Ford and Sloan were the first to perfect the entire system. Plant operations, supplier coordination, management of the entire enterprise, and to couple it with a new conception of the market and a new distribution system. Thus, the auto industry became the global symbol of mass production. The complete system spread rapidly to other industries in the United States in the 1920s, and was soon embraced by practically all volume manufacturing industries. In addition, mass production was tried, without much success, in one-of-a-kind craft industries, in particular housing, where a number of entrepreneurs set out to become the Henry Ford of the home. In Europe, the idea of mass production was a problem not just for the auto industry, but in every industry. On one level, the intellectuals, particularly on the left, embraced the idea of mass production as the obvious means to elevate the living conditions of the masses. Soon the images of mass production and modernity were a central theme of European art. However, back at the factory, in every type of manufacture, the poor fit between the requirements of mass production and the craft orientation of both workers and managers ensured that adoption of the new techniques was very slow. The lack of an integrated European market was a further impediment. It was only after World War II that mass production was fully embraced across the industrial landscape of Europe, in many cases through use of guest workers from other countries and cultures, who were willing to tolerate the monotony of classic mass production in the factory. Just as Ford and Sloan were swimming in the sea of new ideas, the post-war chaos in Japan created a fertile environment for new thinking. Many of the techniques Eiji Toyota and Taiichi Ono built into their lean production system were being tried at the same time in other industries. For example, the quality-enhancing ideas of the American consultant W. Edwards Deming were adopted at about the same time by many Japanese companies across a range of industries. A number of other ideas were forced on these inventors by larger social forces in society. In particular, the need to treat workers as fixed costs once it became apparent that hire and fire labor policies would be strenuously resisted by employees. However, like Ford and Sloan, their achievement lay in putting all the pieces together to create the complete system of lean production, extending from product planning through all the steps of manufacture and supply system coordination on to the customer. Thus, the auto industry once more changed the world and has become the global symbol of the new era of lean production. What's more, as we have seen, lean production combines the best features of both craft production and mass production, the ability to reduce costs per unit and dramatically improve quality, while at the same time providing an ever wider range of products and ever more challenging work. The final limits of the system are not yet known, and its diffusion, both within the auto industry and to other industries, is still at an early state, about where mass production was in the early 1920s. Yet in the end, we believe, lean production will supplant both mass production and the remaining outposts of craft production in all areas of industrial endeavor to become the standard global production system of the 21st century. That world will be a very different and a much better place. Afterword, 2007. What we have learned about lean production since 1990. Machine was an earnest effort to cover a vast territory from a considerable distance. At the time we wrote this book, Toyota and Honda operated mostly in Japan, and the range of research and writing on the details of their value creation systems was limited. Thus, it is not surprising that as our research has continued over nearly two decades, we have learned a great deal about lean production beyond our initial findings. In addition, there are a number of points we would make in a different and better way if we were writing Machine today. Because the book has found a large and enduring audience in business and engineering schools, where it often serves as a core text on state-of-the-art business management, we are particularly anxious to bring the historical and technical details up to date. The first point of elaboration concerns the origins of lean production. At the time we wrote Machine, we were quite familiar with Toyota's history, but we were a bit weak on what Henry Ford had done. The Henry Ford we knew and wrote about was the older Henry Ford of the massive Rouge complex just south of Detroit. Opened in 1917 as a torpedo boat factory for the American government in World War I, it was completed at the time of the conversion from the Model T to the Model A in 1927. This was certainly the temple of mass production that we describe. Shortly after publication, we ran across a copy of the long out-of-print masterpiece by Horace Arnold and Fay Farot, Ford Methods and the Ford Shops, published by Engineering Magazine in 1915. This discovery was fortunate to our subsequent writing because we immediately realized that there were actually two Henry Fords. The first was the dynamic Henry Ford of the Highland Park factory on the north side of Detroit, who reached his zenith in 1914 when he introduced what he called flow production. He meant by this term that he had not only perfected the continuous flow final assembly line, but had also arranged in a tight process sequence the many types of metalworking machines needed to fabricate the components going into the Model T. This arrangement made it possible to have a very nearly continuous flow of production from raw material to finished product. For example, the Model T running board was fabricated by sending steel blanks one at a time through a cleaning machine, a rolling press, a drawing press, a washing machine, a paint tank, and a bake oven, all within a tiny area located not far from the point of attachment to the running board to the vehicle on the final assembly line. See Arnold and Farot, 251-56, for details and photos of this example. This prototypical production cell was sized to run at the rate needed by the final assembly line. Many of the modules going into the car, dashboard, running boards, front suspension, rear suspension, and axle, engine, transmission, gas tank, and fuel lines, were made in similar layouts near the final assembly line, and in nearly continuous flow at the exact rate of the line, and with very short throughput time from start to finish. Ford's production control system could therefore be very simple as well. In many cases, a module production area was simply instructed to work until a maximum allowable amount of inventory was on hand at the final assembly point. Production would then stop until told to proceed by shortage chasers, who cycled continually through the plant from assembly areas to component production areas, passing out production instructions. A crude pull system. See Arnold and Farot, 63-72, for details on this example. The second Henry Ford was the brittle Henry Ford of the completed Rouge, where the predominant mode of organization was process villages, or more accurately, process cities of enormous scale. These cities performed in one building or area all of a given type of task. Stamping, painting, welding, machining, for the whole complex. Highland Park was designed with small washing systems, small paint booths, standalone stamping presses, and other technologies.